I'm Linda van Tolberg for Business, and I have somebody who's from a very rare breed, an African bobsledder, Mike Stevens, with me. Hi, Mike, and welcome to Business.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Do you realize how odd that sounds, an Africa bobsledder?
Sure. I mean, it was strange to me when I started talking about it as well. Add not only from Africa and bobsledding, but also disabled on top of that. And it's a strange trio of information to put together.
Yeah, well, it always reminds me of that movie called Runnings.
Yeah, I mean, the Jamaicans still have a bobsled team. I see them training in some of the places we visit. So, yeah, the idea that places with the summer, that where you're dominated by summer, don't take part in winter sport is gone. I think it's also the competition now in the winter sports and things is also at a much higher level as well. So yeah, it's a little bit different, but there's a chance for everybody. You just need a bit of an opportunity to try it.
Well, for South Africans or people overseas who might not know your story, tell us, who is Michael Stevens?
I was born in Johannesburg, South Africa. I've grown up in Johannesburg, South Africa. Basically a normal South African childhood up until I was 12 years old. When I was 12 years old, I was involved in an electrical accident, electrocuted by high tension wires that resulted in burn injuries to 70% of my body. My legs were the worst impacted by the injuries and required amputation in order to save my life, to make sure that I wasn't impacted by infection and other things that would have killed me. So yeah, I had an amputation 5 days after my accident and then spent a year inside hospital, pretty much just having skin put back on and you know, getting to a basic level. And then from there, I was probably in and out of hospital for another 2 years with doctors kind of telling me what they thought they could do to fix me. But yeah, just got tired of all of that in the process and wanted to get back to my life. And in the background, I was starting that. So going back to my old school and figuring out how to move around in a wheelchair and to adapt to my new situation. And yeah, I mean, I then went into high school. I spent 2 years getting carried up and down stairs and navigating the school in the wheelchair before I got my first set of privately made reasonable prosthetics. And then that changed my mobility levels because now I was able to walk and navigate stairs and find a different level of mobility. Finished high school like that. And by the time I finished high school, in my brain, I'd, you know, fully adapted and I was highly mobile and wanting to do things. I knew I wasn't going to go to university straight away. So I took a year off and went traveling. I backpacked around Europe. I traveled around the East Coast of America and then went to work in the Caribbean as a charter boat crew for a while. Came back from that experience to attend university, did an undergrad at University of Johannesburg in marketing and public relations, did a postgraduate in business administration at Wits Business School, got into a graduate program within BMW, won that graduate program, chose to go work within the dealership structure, did that for 3 years before I decided that I think I want to do something else, went traveling again for 6 months, came back, took another job within the motor industry as a manager within the dealership, did management and upper management for 2 years, and then decided I actually wanted to do my own thing and not be in a corporate environment. That's where I got caught in a difficult situation in that I got caught where I couldn't afford my own prosthetics for a period because all of my money was invested in the business and what I was trying to do. And that gave me a bit of a wake-up call into some of the questions I was asking myself was, well, if I have just been caught out by this and I'm reasonably well educated and, you know, have savings and understand the situation, what happens to other people, specifically children in my situation, where they might have been born into the situation or like me have had an accident, how would they get out of it? And that thought process just wouldn't go away.
So that led to Jumping Kids. That's the charity.
Correct.
Was it you started or did you
join? I joined it. So basically what happened there, in that period I was training for rowing to try and go to the London Paralympics. And I met a prosthetist who was aiming to help out the South African teams with their equipment. He and I started talking. He had told me that he'd just come back from overseas and, you know, had started this nonprofit because he was meeting all these kids who needed help. And was I interested in being involved in mentoring? And yeah, I mean, I basically stepped in as kind of a mentor, but then saw an opportunity because a big brand in South Africa was running a competition where they were offering professionals the chance to work for a nonprofit of their choice, where they would give you a small stipend and a year's worth of support to try and assist that nonprofit and let you bring your skills to it, uplift it and develop it. And it all kind of just came together at the same time. So I said to Johan, the founder of Jumping Kids, why don't I take this opportunity and we see if we can't do something to develop this in a year and, you know, do some good. We did that. I won the competition. I did the year. And in that year, met some incredible kids and realized that they needed more support. And there was a real big opportunity here to help and to potentially even build a legacy that could solve these issues for many more people. And that then became the process of developing Jumping Kids into something bigger. That's sure, it's about 13, 14 years ago now. And that's what we tried to do then. I've taken the nonprofit and tried to develop it from a pure nonprofit into a social enterprise, something that has a bit more business behind it with a plan to make it bigger and to assist the challenges faced by many disabilities within the country, specifically amputation, around mobility issues and accessing the equipment.
I've seen some of the stories on your website. I mean, small little kids, and to see what difference it makes just to get blades or the different kind of prosthetics that you offer. And it's just incredible.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's something that I take personal knowledge and understanding from, is the difference that the equipment makes. It's a fundamental change to somebody who requires it. It takes all those limitations and minimizes them. So, you know, a child born into a disability that affects their mobility, it knocks onto how they are seen in their community, how they are able to play with kids in the community, whether they are able to go to school. You know, many schools won't accept kids with a disability. So those knock-on effects then are the issue for me, because if a child is disabled and then is limited by not being allowed to just enter school to get an education, then we disable them further to the point of, if we don't intervene, if we don't create structures that allow them to gain some form of education, some form of development, then we are literally just allowing them to be a social grant candidate and reach a point where they are not unhelpable, but in a much more difficult situation than if we had just dealt with it early. So the stories we see, I mean, we are, you know, part of the solution for kids as young as 1 year old. We meet them at birth, where they come to a congenital birth defect clinic. We meet their parents. We go through the process of what's going to be involved. And if everybody buys in, then, you know, when they would be walking at age one, we're doing the fitments and they're walking at age one, potentially. A single leg below knee amputee shouldn't miss any milestones if they have the equipment. And that then has knock-on effects for the schooling. The schooling has knock-on effects for the community. So we know the impact it makes and the difference it makes. And that's why we want to be a part of that solution. It started out purely as a mobility desire, trying to get the kids mobile. But once we were achieving that, then it became, well, if we're going to spend all the money to get them mobile, then while they're attending this school that doesn't go to matric, isn't very effective, you know, what's the next step? And the next step became education. So we offer bursary support as well as just, you know, support around the kids and their guardians to get them into mainstream schooling, to go and deal with the schools, and then sporting opportunities. So we have a sports club and we work with the schools as well to say, well, you know, this kid is mobile, is very effective. Can they not play soccer, rugby, etc. with the school? Even if they don't make the team, you know, let them play. And then privately, we also then look for their talents and see if there are para sport federations we can link them to, whether that's athletics, tennis, swimming, rowing, bobsled, whatever.
Let's get to your personal quest. You said you almost went to the London Olympics, but then you switched sport to para bob, which is amazing. Tell us, where does this thing about the Olympics, you want to be an Olympian, come from?
Well, it's actually more to do with I've always been very sporty and active. So before my accident, I played junior level, national sport, soccer, cricket, tennis, all sorts of things. And then I had my accident, and obviously I still wanted to be involved in sport. So I did rowing with the school and played social tennis and various other sports, but I was always very physically active. So whenever I got involved in some level of parasport, it kind of just led me to a point where you're like, well, you know, we're right by qualification. Why don't we go for it now? So that always just, it kind of was, the Paralympics was never a goal. It just always kind of became something that I ended up knocking on the door of because I liked sports and was active. I never achieved it for various reasons, from classification issues. This is where the Paralympics can get quite technical, where you're classified according to disabilities. And because there's so many different things that can happen, your classification might not be what you expect it to be, which would then have a knock-on effect or an implication for your competitiveness within the sport. So within rowing, I wanted to go as individual, a race in a skull. But in the end, the classification that I was put in meant I had to row in a team event, male, female, a double, which meant I had to find a teammate, which was the problem. And then when I found a teammate, she unfortunately got injured about 3 months before the games. And that was it. That was the end of that option. Then I've always been involved in sailing. My father went to the Barcelona Olympics for sailing. My brother was a charter boat captain in the Caribbean. I was the junior sailor when a few accidents. So I then got involved in sailing, was getting to a competitive level, started to have that same thought again. Sailing was dropped from the games. So, you know, you're not going for that. So it was always more just competitive and being involved in things. Then I was taking part in kite surfing socially, learning how to do that and, you know, kind of pioneering that because there weren't that many people with disabilities involved. And then I went to a camp in Greece with a bunch of other guys and met a guy from Switzerland who was also starting out in kite surfing. We became friends. And yeah, then 2 years later, he was the actual inspiration. And so he phoned me and said, "What do you think of bobsledding?" And, you know, I defaulted to the same thing everybody else does. It was like, yeah, cool runnings. It was a great movie. I had, you know, fun to watch. And then he said, well, what about doing it? Because he was doing it and para bobsled was trying to get into the Winter Olympics because it wasn't a sport included. They were looking for more people and ideally other continents and places where it's not done so that they could show that it was growing and could develop. So he was my inspiration and invite to go give it a try. I put it out to a couple of people, but they were kind of...
way too dangerous.
Yeah, well, there was, I think it's too dangerous, and then I think it's too cold, and then, you know, it sounds fun, but like it's too much money, and I'm going to have to take 2 weeks off of work, and no. So, you know, luckily for Chris and the others, I'm generally the person who can make time if I decide to do things. So I got involved in the beginning and then really connected with the people who were involved in it and the other competitors and started to believe in the goal and be a part of the goal to take it to the Paralympics. So that's where we are. There are 12 nations who have committed to send a competitor to compete in the Parabob season every year for at least 4 years in order for us to meet the qualification standards.
But I see that it's not been included in 2026 in Milan.
No. Again, this is where, you know, the complications, the politics, the stuff around sports and trying to get things done, you know, can be immensely frustrating. But we're now on the path. So we missed inclusion for 2026 on a technicality. And now we are waiting for the decision for 2030. So as it stands right now, the decision will be made next year. If we get in for 2030, there's a chance that we'll be an exhibition event at 2026. So a non-medal event. We'll go to the games, we'll race to show what's possible, but it won't be for medals. 2030 would then be for medals. So most of us actually who are currently competing and trying to get it to the games will never actually go to the games.
Just listening to you, that you always find this goal and that you're so inspired and you've got everything that the South Africans called fast-paced. Where does this come from? Where does this reserve of strength come from?
Part of it is a South African thing. I think it's built into the culture of Africa's a tough place, so learn to deal. And then, you know, there's family structure as well. My family has quite a stoic approach to life, and that's been something I've grown up with. You know, that there are going to be challenges, and don't get too upset or too happy or any of it. Just understand that that's what it is and continue to push to chase the things that are important to you and important to how you want to write your story, tell your life, live your life. So yeah, there's a cultural, there's a family, and then there's a life experience. I've had to learn all of those skills in my accident. When you spend a year in hospital, essentially by yourself, your life is different. You've had your whole world reshaped. There's an element of what's next. And I think that you have the worst case scenarios and the bad stuff that floats through your head. But I think everybody still has goals and desires. And my approach to life has always been to find those things that are important to me, the things that I want to do, and the way that I want to live my life and tell my story, and to then chase those and to live like that. I mean, at this stage, it's also, you know, it was always natural for me, but at this stage, it's also become, I realized that I am an example for all of the jumping kids that I assist. My approach to things and the way that I live is going to be seen by them and might be an example for them and a reflection of what they need to do. And therefore, I need to live up to the things I talk about.
You've mentioned that Jumping Kids is a charity, but you want to turn it into a social enterprise. What are your plans with that?
I believe that the prosthetic industry is still operating and using techniques that have been around since World War II. There's ways to revitalize the industry. With Johan and what I learned from him, he redeveloped a socket technology, the way the sockets are made, which changed the business workflow. I'm then looking at the way the businesses are done in most parts of the country and saying it's done to be small scale and manage niche amounts of customers. If we start looking at the scale of this and we upscale and we train and we set up a sort of central fabrication, employ prosthetists, train them to do the work the way that we would do the work, it offers multiple opportunities in terms of being able to deal with the backlog on issues within the country firstly, but then within Africa as a whole. We can become a leader in the continent for the delivery of these services, which means we can offer it continent-wide and expand. And then we can change the narrative around people with disabilities. So we can give them the equipment, which makes them mobile, which gives them the opportunity to work. You know, a simple thing like somebody who loses their leg below the knee in a car accident or some sort of trauma, they're now on crutches until they get a solution. Solutions given by the state can take anywhere from 3 to 5 years. That's 3 to 5 years of not being able to work. If I give them a solution, if I find a way to make this cheaper, easier, more accessible, and we give them a solution, those crutches disappear within a day. Their hands are free. That frees them up to carry a cup and a plate in their house. Firstly, it frees them up to work and be able to earn an income for themselves and their family. So I'm looking at how do I reject the industry that allows us to serve more people and offer a better service to people, because that'll solve so many issues within our country in terms of job creation, social development, social grant savings, etc. So I think the industry is there for a rework, and I think that South Africa could be a leader within Africa, if not the world. And so my goal is to develop that and to train the people and to get a proof of concept together. And so I've been pitching it for a while, but this is my year to really push and to get the social enterprise stuff right. Because the other side is if I get the business end right, it becomes easier to do the charity work as well.
How big is the need? How many amputees are there?
Well, okay, so this becomes an issue of reporting because we don't have great reporting within the continent, let alone within the country. We see reports of, you know, there being hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people requiring the equipment and expanding because of issues like diabetes, especially in people over 45. Diabetes is creating a huge issue. The numbers there are easier to trace because they track them. So I would say the market is millions of people within children and jumping kids, hundreds of thousands of kids in Africa alone. I currently support around 165 kids throughout the country. That's all their equipment, all the maintenance. And then within those, I have kids who are on bursaries, probably about 35 to 40 of those. And then another 60 or so who take part in sports within that. And we're completely overrun by that number because I need to build the scale and the skills to be able to handle further. The market is massive and growing because there's more trauma happening in the world. You know, the Ukraine war has probably added thousands of amputees alone. The statistics aren't good. Nobody collates the information effectively, but on requests and the demand that we see just from people and people on the side of the road and it's massive and underserved completely.
Michael Stevens, thank you very much.
Thanks.